So today, as I mentioned, we honor Indigenous Peoples Day, and we're joined by a very special guest. Alan Salazar is a Chumash and Tataviam elder. He's a traditional storyteller and paddler of the Chumash canoes. And his family roots go back millennia on this sacred land, as you will hear. Now, we give thanks for these beautiful mountains and sacred lands on which we're meeting, with gratitude to the Chumash people who have been in this area for over 13,000 years. Welcome into our community, Alan. We're so glad that you could be with us here today. Please.
I tell people all the time that in Native communities throughout America, that there's been a break in many tribes, a break and a gap between generations and elders. So my father was born in 1924, and the first thing he had to survive was the Great Depression. And then he fought in World War II as a Marine. So he didn't have the opportunity to learn a lot of the old traditions, a lot of the old stories and the old ways. So I cherish when I learn a story the old way from an elder, from a storyteller. And this story I'm going to share, I learned from a Chumash elder from Santa Ynez, Tony Romero. And Tony was just a wonderful elder, wonderful man. And I heard him tell this story numerous times, and then I asked him if I could share that story, asked for permission. And he said, yes, please, you know, take that story. I know you go to a lot of schools and talk to a lot of young people, talk to people about our culture. So take the story of Muhu, the Great Horned Owl. And As I said, I learned this story the old way. I've never seen it written down, and I'm sure it is written down somewhere. Those of you that know what a great horned owl looks like, you know that it has feather-like ears, hence the name Great Horned. It has yellow eyes and a curved beak. It's a rather large bird, tremendous hunter, very respected. But long, long ago, Muhu, the great horned owl, was a songbird. He didn't look anything like he looks today. He had a round, slick head, small little brown beady eyes, and a long, pointy beak that he would whistle and sing beautiful songs. And all the animals would come and listen to Muhu, the songbird, sing his songs. Now one day, Hoos the grizzly bear was listening to Muhu sing his songs. And after listening to Muhu the songbird sing his songs, Hoos the grizzly bear called up to him. He says, Muhu, come down here. Let me give you just a little hug because I love your songs so much. They're so beautiful. And Muhu thought, he seems friendly. He says he just wants to give me a little hug. Figured he was a groupie. What the heck? He flew down out of his tree. When he got close to Hoos the grizzly bear, he saw how big he is. Over 7 feet tall when he stands on his hind legs. Claws as big as my fingers. And Muhu the songbird got scared and flew away. The next day, Muhu the songbird was curious. Was Hoos friendly? Did he just want to give him a little hug? So he went to the same tree. And once again, he was singing his beautiful songs. Hoos, once again, yelled up at Muhu, the songbird. He goes, Muhu, Muhu, come here. Let me give you just a little hug of appreciation because I love your songs. They're so beautiful. And Muhu flew down out of the tree And he got too close to Hoos, and Hoos reached out and grabbed him, and he gave him a big old bear hug. He goes, "Oh, Muhu, your songs are so beautiful. I'm going to give you a hug." And Muhu says, "I don't know, you're pretty strong. Don't give me a hug." He goes, "Oh, I'm just going to give you one little hug because I love your song so much." He went, "Oh!" and gave him a hug. A little hug to a grizzly bear is a big hug to any of us. He hugged him so hard those feather ears popped out. And Muhu goes, "Hoos, don't give me any more hugs. You don't know how strong you are." And Hoos goes, "Oh, let me give you just one more hug because I love your songs. They're so beautiful." He said, "I'll just give you a little hug." He went, "Oh!" Give him another hug. He hugged him so hard those little brown beady eyes popped out and turned yellow. Muhu says, "Hoos, don't give me any more hugs. You don't know how strong you are." He goes, "Okay, I won't give you any more hugs, but I love your song so much, I'm going to give you a kiss." And he went, "Mwah!" He gave him a big, wet, sloppy kiss on that beautiful long beak. Has anyone ever kissed a grizzly bear? Don't do it. They have the worst breath. His breath was so bad, that beautiful long beak went and bent over. And that's how Muhu the songbird became Muhu the great horned owl. I'll give you an example. If I didn't have the flute accompanist today, this is what you would have had to listen to. Muhu was in the tree singing his beautiful songs. Those of you from my generation know this, Otis Redding sitting at the dock of the bay. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed the story.
We're blessed by Alan's presence here today with us. So we wanted to see what cause lies closest to his heart to do a special collection today. And he told me that he'd be so grateful if we raised funds for the Tatavium Land Conservancy to be able to protect and preserve open space and lands in this area. But I'll have Alan tell you much more about it.
The Fernandinho Tatavium and the Ventureño Chumash are both federally non-recognized tribes. That means we get nothing from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We don't get any federal monies for health clinics or anything like that. And we have no land, which is one of the reasons why the Bureau of Indian Affairs does not recognize us. And my Fernandinho Tatavium tribe, for a federally non-recognized tribe, we're extremely organized and have been for years. We have our own education department, PAKU, and it works with all tribal members, elders, and it helps them learn about their culture. And it works a lot with young people, and we take them out in the summer on various field trips and camping things to experience the land that their ancestors used to live and hunt on. So a couple months ago, we went through all the legal hoops of starting our own nonprofit, our own land conservancy. And to put it simply, the Tatavium Land Conservancy is the same as the Sierra Club or the Santa Monica Nature Conservancy. In fact, we're going to partner with them and work with them probably on our first couple land acquisitions because we're starting from ground zero. So we're trying to raise funds so that we can buy some of that land that is still open space that's not built on, and preserve that land forever and for the future generations, that our young tribal members will have their traditional native lands that they can go hiking on, that they can go and just say prayers, go out and collect sage and toyon and elderberry and willow the way our peoples did for thousands and thousands of years. So our land conservancy is something that we're extremely proud of, and we're just starting. So these donations will literally be our starter to help get us off the ground and acquire our first nature preserve. So thank you so much for being so generous of helping the Jatavayam Land Conservancy. Thank you.
The very survival of humankind depends on developing concern for the whole of humanity, not just their own community or nation, writes Joanna Macy. It is with that spirit that the indigenous peoples of this land welcomed immigrants to their shores over 500 years ago. Unfortunately, this understanding of humanity and hospitality was not returned. As we are all sadly, if not guiltily, aware, domination and oppression by colonizers has plagued the Americas ever since. Now, there's an intense and alarming national debate these days about who actually belongs in this country. And as I reflected on this question, I wrestled with this idea of land ownership, of nationalism and borders. Whose land is this? Indeed, does it really belong to anyone? Land ownership and a concern for one's own people at the expense of others has been the cause of most battles and wars throughout history. But how did borders and nationalism come to exist? Now, over millennia, we know that nations were established due to naturally occurring geographic boundaries like oceans and lakes, mountains, forests, or rivers. But borders were also drawn as a grab for resources, and thus for power and money. Borders have changed over time due to war, colonization, politics, treaties, or trade. But like the concept of race, borders are an artificial construct that creates separation and division, a sense of us and them. So as I explored this question of who belongs here in the United States, a country in which borders didn't begin to appear until colonization began in the 15th century, there's no doubt that if this land belongs to anyone, it belongs to the indigenous peoples. Now, Canadians call them the First Peoples for obvious reasons. They've lived on this land for over 13,000 years, my friends. They arrived here either by way of the Bering Straits land bridge, or some people are now discovering, Alan told me, that they came in an even earlier maritime culture that was able to cross the Pacific from East Asia. Can you imagine? The first peoples of this land existed here peacefully for over 12,500 years before colonizers came and claimed the land for themselves. The rest of us who arrived here over the last 500 years are immigrants. We come from a line of explorers, colonizers, opportunists, refugees, indentured servants, and people who were forcibly removed from their homelands and brought here into enslavement. Now, Indigenous peoples and our UU faith tell us that we are all interconnected. The plants, the animals, the earth, the oceans, and each human being on it. Native Americans have understood this symbiotic relationship with Mother Earth long before our scientists and environmentalists began to understand native plants and animals and how ecosystems function to bring balance. But particularly at this time, as we near a tipping point in climate change, may we turn to our elders, the First Peoples, and humbly ask their forgiveness for our mistreatment of them, as well as for our poor custodianship of this glorious land. Together, may we better learn how to treat this land and its ancient people with the respect understanding, and consideration that they deserve. And now I'd like to invite Alan to come and share your ancestors' story of belonging on this land. Thank you for honoring us with your presence here today.
Thank you, dear. In many tribal cultures in America, song is always part of ceremony. And as I was sitting here listening to the wonderful choir, I thought back of when I was a young man, a young boy, that I consider myself blessed that I grew up in a time in the 60s. And I know your thought is, I don't look that old. But those of us that grew up in the 60s grew up, and as a young boy, we moved from Hanford to Bakersfield. So I went to school with Buck Owens' kids. So you couldn't get away from not listening to Buck and Merle and Johnny Cash. But I'm from that generation that we grew up with Chuck Berry, Aretha Franklin, Jimi Hendrix, Elvis, those four dudes from England. Just a wide range of music. And as I said, Native peoples, we always incorporate music in our prayers and in our ceremonies. So, repeat after me. Aheya, heya, ungawa. Aheya, heya, ungawa. This is an elderberry clapper stick. It's made from elderberry wood. It's simply split, hollowed out, and it keeps the rhythm of the song. So clap your hands to this beat. Now sing the song. Aheya, heya, ungawa. So that song is simply saying, welcome, welcome, everyone. My name is Alan Salazar. Those of you that weren't here at the first gathering, I am the son of Abel and Teresa Salazar, the grandson of Manuel and Vera Salazar, and the great-grandson of Antonio Maria Ortega. My family was brought to the San Fernando Mission starting in 1799. So for the last five, six generations, my native family, that I get on my father's side of my family, have lived mostly in and near the town of San Fernando and the San Fernando Mission. We trace back through San Fernando Mission records to the village of Tuapu, which is just right down the road a little bit. We now call it Simi Valley. And to the village of Chagoyanga, where more of you have probably been with your kids. Magic Mountain is now built over my Tataviam village. My ancestors were brought into the San Fernando Mission and were forced to build it and were part of the forced slave labor force at the mission for several generations. I've had a unique relationship with organized religion, and especially the Catholic religion. I was raised Catholic and went to Mass every Sunday with my family. But as I got older and became adult, I studied and researched my two tribes and how they survived. What was their religious beliefs? And I've learned a few simple things that, in my opinion, my tribes, the tribes here in California, that their religious beliefs are based on nature, and they're based in a simple concept of respect. That you, if you don't do ceremony in a good way, with a good heart and an open heart, if you don't do ceremony at the proper time and pay respect, then you will not be successful and bad things will happen to you. The mission priests, when they came, they heard the latter part, that if we don't do ceremony, bad things will happen to you. You won't be successful. And they interpreted that as we were a simple culture, that we were superstitious. Like many concepts that are simple, we should all love each other. It's a simple concept, should be easily accomplished. But as we all know today, it's not that easily accomplished. Being respectful of everything in our world seems like a simple concept. But we all get up late every now and then and drive a little too fast, burn a little bit more gas, stop and get that plastic bottle of water because that's all we have time for. Go through the drive-thru at McDonald's instead of eating good, healthy foods. We all take those shortcuts, and all those things affect negatively our environment and the world that we live in. We get angry when we're driving on the 101 or the 405. All those things affect our simple life goals. And to say that the Chumash and the Tetavaim were a simple culture is not understanding the complexity of being respectful. That when we collected acorns in the fall, right now, this time of the year, we would be out collecting acorns. If you look at our oak trees, many of them have acorns on them. The first dropping of the acorns, that first drop, we didn't collect those. We left those for the animals. Now, some of those animals that were going to eat those acorns were animals that we were going to hunt and eat ourselves. So we wanted to make sure the deer had enough to eat. But we also wanted to make sure that the acorn woodpecker, who we just admired for his beauty, his beautiful red head, but that the acorn woodpeckers had their share of acorns and all the other small creatures. And then the second dropping of the acorns, so oak trees, they have an early dropping and then they have a later dropping. They'll drop part of the acorns, will be on the ground. We left those for the animals. The second dropping, those were the ones that we collected. So native wisdom, when you look at it, it seems simple, but it's extremely complex. There was a gentleman that was from the Yai tribe that is now extinct. And the Yai tribe was in the mountains east of Sacramento. Part of the reason why they are extinct is that during the mission period, half of the California native population did not survive. So our population was approximately 300,000 prior to the missions. By the end of the mission period in the 1840s, our population was 150,000 throughout the state. It was cut in half. The Catholic Church today still says that it was mostly disease that the California Indians died from, that our immune system could not fight off diseases that we hadn't been exposed to. I believe that's like what my theme of my talk this morning, that something seems simple, but actually there's more complex when you look a little deeper. All the native peoples, all the Chumash, Tetavaam, Tongva Gabrielino that were brought to the San Fernando Mission, if you were over 10 years of age, You were treated like an adult. So from 10 to 70, 10 to 80, you worked from sunrise to sunset. You were fed very little food. You don't have to be a doctor to know that if you work hard physical work and are fed very little food, your immune system is weakened. So had we experienced chickenpox, smallpox before? No. But we were a strong, hardy people. We would send our runners to villages 100 miles away to find out what the hunting was like. If their oak trees had a lot of acorns, and they would run that 100 miles and turn around and run 100 miles back, many times in one day. We would paddle our canoes, our tamoles, up and down the coast. They're flat-bottom canoes. They carry a lot of weight. They're very slow. They're very heavy. We would take a 24, 25-foot canoe and go out and catch 300-400 pounds of fish. We would take 400-500 pounds of trade items out to the islands where the other Chumash people lived and paddled across that island. The last few canoes were built in Ventura, and the last two were lost in a storm. And they put three men in each canoe, and they paddled out almost to Santa Cruz Island, which from Ventura is over 20 miles. So they paddled about 20 miles out fishing, turned around, paddled back fishing all the way, paddled probably a good 40 miles, and then one canoe was lost a couple miles off the coast of Ventura, and the other one made it ashore, but it was destroyed in the surf as they landed. We were a strong, and still are a strong, hardy people. So for the Catholic Church to say that it was disease that killed us, to me, that's not the complete truth. We were worked to death. And I'll just use myself as an example. I've had several of those diseases. If it was because my native ancestry is not strong enough to survive, I should not be here. I had the chickenpox. I had the mumps. I survived. I probably had valley fever, my doctor told me, as I got older, because I have some scar tissue on my lungs. We are a tough, hardy people, and we're still here. We still build our canoes. We still sing our songs. We still make offerings and say prayers. Ishi was from the Yahi tribe and came down out of the mountains in the early 1920s, and he was the last of his tribe. They didn't survive the genocide from 1848 to 1873. Thousands and thousands of California Indians were killed, and people were paid to kill them. There was a bounty system. And our population dropped from 140 to less than 20,000. Many of the tribes were close to extinction, and several of them were. One of them was Ishi's tribe, the Yahi. They're gone. And he was the last member of that tribe. When he came down out of the mountains after living by himself for years and years, he looked like a homeless man. Tattered clothes and dirty. And the leading anthropologist at that time was Alfred Kroeber. Alfred Kroeber was one of the most respected anthropologists of his time in America and in the world. He was a professor at Cal Berkeley, one of the top universities in America at its time. And when he saw Ishi, he realized who he was, that he was the last of his tribe. So he took him in. He lived at the museum there at Berkeley, and he interviewed him and wrote down everything that he knew, his language, the use of plants, the animals that they hunted. And he thought, I'll take Ishi and we'll go back to his homeland and camp out for a week or so. And he invited some of his other college professors, some of the most learned, intelligent men in America at that time. And in their own words, in his book, this is what he says, that as soon as we got out to Ishi's land and set up camp, set up our tents, Ishi became the teacher, and we became the students. And they were amazed at how many plants he knew and what they were used for, which ones were poisonous, which ones were edible, which ones could be used for medicine. His knowledge was immense. So to say that we're simple tribal people does not do us justice. I am proud to say that I have helped build and paddle in traditional Chumash canoes for over 20 years. I'm at the end of my paddling career. I hope to paddle a few more years so I can get my grandson involved. But I can leave today and never paddle another mile in our traditional Chumash plank canoes, our tamoles, our ocean canoes. And I would be satisfied with my career, and I would have no worry because our young paddlers, our young people, have picked up that torch, and they will carry on. And I know that we, the Chumash, will be paddling in our canoes for generations because of our young people. I've paddled with a dear friend of mine. We all make fun of each other because I'm a couple years older than Reggie Pagaline and a couple years younger than Marcus Lopez. So we make fun to make sure that we are wearing our hearing aids and that we have our dentures in real tight before we paddle. But I've also had the honor of paddling with Reggie's daughter, Eva. And I got a little worried that I might have been a bad influence on Eva because one of my jobs with our canoes is to mentor and teach our young paddlers. Reggie, her father, is a captain. He's a navigator. So he navigates. He's the leader. When he's in the tamal, he's the leader. He's the captain of that crew. We follow his instructions. He's responsible for our safety. I enjoy the physical challenge of paddling. We paddle on our knees. Our paddles are over 11 feet long, made of wood. They're very heavy, double-bladed. Takes a lot of upper body strength. And I had the honor of being in the tamal when Eva paddled on the first crossing. And she wanted to paddle because her stepmom, Claudia, who we all love dearly, had passed from breast cancer. And she wanted to paddle in her first crossing and make an offering in the middle of the Pacific Ocean on her way to Limu, Santa Cruz Island, which she did. And I had the honor of being in the tamal with her. And when you paddle in open waters, it's not unusual to paddle. And if the swells are going up and down, that when you go to put your blade in the water on the right, if the swell's going down, you catch air. And you have to stay in that rhythm. You don't jerk. You stay in the rhythm so every paddle hits the water and comes out at the same time, that you're not clanking paddles. Any competitive paddler will tell you that your blade of each paddler has to hit the water at exactly the same time and pull back at exactly the same time if you really want to propel your tamal forward. And I was right behind Eva. I saw every stroke she took. I saw every swell that came over the front and soaked her with water. And it's literally like getting a 5-gallon bucket of water and having someone throw a 5-gallon bucket of water. And when that happened, she did not miss a stroke. She was not out of rhythm at any time. And I was extremely proud of this young woman. And I am sure that she will be one of our leaders. She will take over for me as a paddler. She will take over for her father as a captain. And the scary part is I've been doing something for years that at some point I'm going to draw attention to thunder and lightning. And it's a running gag within my tamal family. Reggie will even set me up. He'll go, "Alan," if there's a group of people. He goes, "Which way are we going to paddle today?" And I'll go, "We're going to paddle that way." After that first crossing, and since then, last year, Eva paddled in her first dark water crew. The dark water crew is the most respected crew that we have. They're dark water paddlers because when we paddle out to Santa Cruz Island, we leave at 3 a.m. and it's dark. And it's incredible paddling because it's dark. You can't even see your blade hitting the water lots of times. So you literally are paddling by feel. I've been paddling long enough that when I'm in the front of the tumult, because everyone's following my rhythm, if it's daylight, I will close my eyes. And I've gotten in my rhythm. I'm in my zone. I don't have to see. We're in the middle of the ocean. And that closing my eyes, where I'm just feeling my blade hit the water as I pull it out, pull it through and pull it out. Feeling that blade hit the water, it's just an incredible feeling. There's only been two women that have been in that first crew. We've gone 13 times. There's only two women that are dark water paddlers. One of them is Eva Pagelin. She's our future. She's going to be our first woman captain. That's why I can step down today and never paddle again and be reassured that my tribe, my Chumash tribe, my Tataviam tribe will carry on, because we have young people that are just as dedicated and determined to share our culture, to teach people about the atrocities that happened to us, but that we survived those atrocities. And we're still here, we're still building canoes, we're bringing back our language. The one thing we're not bringing back, and I kind of have mixed feelings about this, in all honesty, one of the things that caused us problems with the mission priests was our attitude on sex. We were kind of open. And our thought was, if you're going to paddle a canoe up and down the ocean and go across that channel, that's extremely dangerous. Men were lost many times. Brotherhood of the Tumult, the men who built the canoes, paddled in them, although we also believe our women built and paddled in their own canoes. But it was very dangerous to paddle from the mainland out to the islands. Many men were lost. So it wasn't unusual for the men that were the fishermen and navigated the canoes out to the islands to have a wife and family out on Limu and have a wife and family back here at Saptoon in Santa Barbara, and maybe a wife and family at Shishalope in Ventura, and maybe another wife and family out on Santa Rosa Island. So when we were brought into the mission, that I think that might have caused us some problems. Padres can be a little rigid at times. So we've had many discussions about this. Not really. But we're not bringing that tradition back. But our tradition of singing our songs, respecting the earth, building our traditional canoes, building our traditional houses, and sharing our stories in the old way, the way I shared that story with you, that's what I know will continue on. Thank you for your time. I apologize if I went a little bit long this time, but thank you. My name is Alan Salazar. I'm the son of Abel and Teresa Salazar, the grandson of Manuel and Vera Salazar, and the great-grandson of Antonio Maria Ortega. My mom was born in Hanford, California. The rest of those people were born in San Fernando, California. My great-great-grandparents were born in San Fernando. My great-great-great-grandparents were born in San Fernando, California. The reason my family has come from the city of San Fernando, for the last five, six generations is that starting in 1799, my ancestors were brought to the San Fernando Mission. They were forced to build it and part of the forced labor force that worked at the mission. My family story is not unique. There's nothing special about my family. What happened to my family happened to thousands and thousands of California Native families. My great-great-great-grandfather was part of a land grant from the San Fernando Mission priest. They gave a square league of land to five Indian families from the San Fernando Mission, five families that had helped build the mission, had worked there, that had family members buried there at the mission. A square league of land is 4,470 acres. The early Spanish influential politicians and wealthy ranchers and wealthy landowners, the wealthy influential Mexican ranchers and politicians knew that the native peoples didn't have any legal rights with Spain or Mexico. They knew that we had no money, that we were poor people that had worked. We were the farm laborers of that time. So they started taxing and fining and assessing fees to those five families. In less than 2 years, they had taken all that 4,470 acres away from those five families because they didn't have money to pay for taxes and various fees and levies that were assessed to those people. It became the Rancho Encino and then became the town of Encino. So if you go south of the 101, a little bit west of the 405, that's where that 4,470 acres is located. If we would have been able to keep that land, we would have been one of the wealthiest tribes in America. A couple of generations after that, my great-grandfather, Antonio Maria Ortega, was born in 1855. He was born at a time when there were bounties on California Indians. How many people are aware of the bounty system that we had here in California? Consider this group way more knowledgeable than most groups I go to. I was at Cal Lutheran last week. None of the students or teachers were aware of the bounty system. The bounty system, basically, when California became a state, the first governor, Governor Burnett, proclaimed that he was going to exterminate all California Indians. He came that close to doing it. When Governor Burnett became the first governor of California, there were approximately 140,000 California Native peoples living throughout the whole state. Down from 300,000, so over half had died during the mission period. By the end of the bounty system, by 1873, the whole state population of Native peoples, they believe, was approximately 20,000. Some anthropologists and historians believe that it was less than 20,000. The bounty system was really simple. Someone could have killed my great-grandfather, and they wouldn't have been sent to jail. They would have been paid for killing my great-grandfather. So thousands and thousands of dollars were paid out in bounties during that period. Thousands of California Indians were murdered and slaughtered. There were actually more massacres in California than there was in any other state in America. Over 300 massacres in California during that period, from 1849 to 1873. So I am lucky to be here. Through family history and stories that were passed down by my grandmother and my great aunts, my great uncles, we are pretty sure that my great-grandfather, my great-great-grandparents, my great-great-grandparents survived one of the most difficult times in America for Native peoples, because they were extremely hardworking and very highly skilled at whatever it was that they did, which is kind of ironic that we were labeled as savages, but in reality, we were very knowledgeable and highly skilled. We knew the animals, we knew the plants. We were highly skilled craftsmen. Our canoe builders were some of the greatest canoe builders that you would have found at that time in the world. So it's a little ironic, but it's probably what saved my family, the fact that they were such hardworking, highly skilled workers. They were just more valuable alive than they were dead. My great-grandfather, Antonio Maria Ortega, was also given some land to him by the San Fernando Mission priest in the early 1870s. He was a young man, 18, 19 years old, but he was a hard worker and had been working at the mission. And the mission priest wanted to reward him and seven other Native families that were still living on or near the mission and help keeping the mission going. At that time, the mission was just a church, so they had no support from the Spanish, Mexican, or U.S. government. So they relied heavily on the Native peoples that they had enslaved, but had become good Catholics. When California became a state and there was the bounty system, as many of you might be aware, we were not U.S. citizens. We didn't become U.S. citizens until 1924. So not only were we not citizens of the United States in the early 1870s, we had zero legal rights. We weren't even allowed to go into court to testify. So if we were all living in the 1870s, and I saw this lady here steal this gentleman's horse, and you look a little shady, young lady, that's why I picked you. You couldn't have me testify in court. I'm Native, I'm an Indian, I would not be allowed in court. So the early settlers in San Fernando, California, the McClays, the Porters, Porter Ranch that has been on fire, realized that these eight Indians that were given some land to them, and it was not a lot, it was a handful of acres so they could farm and survive. Charles McClay, one of the early founders and settlers of San Fernando, if you go to San Fernando, one of the main streets through San Fernando is McClay Avenue. Our tribal office, the Fernandino Tribal Office, is approximately 75, 80 yards away from McClay Avenue. We go on it every day when we go to our tribal office. Charles McClay had those eight families evicted, got the court to assess them all $500 fines for illegally owning land and being squatters, even though the land was given to them by the mission priest. The family story is my great-grandfather, in defiance, refused to leave the land that was given to him. They had to forcibly remove him and handcuff and shackle him and drag him off the land, which was both a bold and stupid thing to do at that time, considering the political climate for Native peoples in California. And the other people were also removed. The most tragic story of those eight families was Rogerio Rocha. Rogerio Rocha lived in a small shack of a house on the few acres that the mission priest had given him, had a small garden. He was in his 80s. His wife was in her 80s. Charles McClay waited till the dead of winter and a big storm and sent the sheriff. He was an extremely powerful and influential man, had been a senator, a congressman, in Sacramento, so he had a lot of power in San Fernando. And he sent the sheriff to evict Rogerio and his 80-year-old wife in the middle of winter, in the middle of a storm. She was sick at the time, and she lived about 2 or 3 days and passed. They had nowhere to go. They lived on the streets. They were basically homeless. Ruggiero lived a couple weeks, and then he died from pneumonia. We are currently, and have been for the last few years, working with the city of San Fernando, and have gained a lot of support from the city council, the mayor of San Fernando, and even the support of a church in San Fernando that was founded by Charles McClay. The pastor of that church has come out in support of my Fernandinho Tataviam tribe to change the name of McClay Avenue to Ruggiero Rocha Avenue. We're still a long ways away from having that happen, but it's our hope and dream to give recognition and some pride to the people that have lived on this land for thousands of years. We ask of all government agencies, of all people that live in this land, just to acknowledge us. Many people think that we're gone, that we're not even here. So just to acknowledge that the Fernandinho Tataviam, the Ventureño Chumash, the Barbareño Chumash, the Gabrielino Tongva, those are not just tribes, those are nations. We try and strive to be sovereign, that the U.S. government will treat us as a nation, and that we'll have a nation-to-nation relationship with the U.S. government. We'll have a nation-to-nation relationship with Ventura County, with the state of California. That's our goal and our dream. That's the dream of all tribes in America. I'll close with a story, a true story that happened when I was a young boy. And as I said, my great-grandfather brazenly refused to leave that land and had to be forced and removed from it when they just could have killed him and received a bounty. And I believe it set a tone for my family. I come from a family of fighters, a family that will stand up for what they believe in, and even against all odds and when it's not the wise or popular thing to do. My father was a Marine, fought in World War II in Saipan and Okinawa. He knew he was going to get drafted, so he joined the Marines because he wanted to be a Marine. And I believe he got that attitude from his grandfather, Antonio Maria Ortega, my great-grandfather. When I was 6 years old, me and my older brother wanted to get Mohawk haircuts, because in our young minds, we thought those were Indian haircuts. It's the only Indian people we saw on TV were on the Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett show, for those of you old enough to remember those. And when you're a young native boy and you're watching television and you see the Indian warriors with Mohawk haircuts, with tomahawks, and they were bad dudes, that's who I wanted to be like. And my older brother and I, we went to Pop and go, "Hey, can we get Mohawk haircuts when school is out for the summer?" He goes, "Okay, yeah." School got out. We went down to the barber shop, Main Street, Hanford, California, which is a small dairy farming, mostly Portuguese dairy farming community, about 30 miles south of Fresno. And we got more Mohawk haircuts. My dad got in the barber's chair, and the barber says, "Take a little off the sides or at the back." He says, "No, give me a Mohawk." And all three of the Salazar boys walked out of that barbershop in 1957 with Mohawk haircuts. That was a bold statement to make. My mom and Pop were one of the few interracial couples in Hanford, California in 1957. The civil rights hadn't started yet. They were ahead of their times. And unbeknownst to me, my sister told me later on when I was older in life, the whole story that I wasn't aware of because I was only 6 years old. And I just wanted to be the baddest six-year-old in Hanford. That's all was my only concern, which I was. But apparently we'd gone to Mass. We were good Catholics, and we went to Mass every Sunday. And we went to Mass a couple weeks before we got the Mohawk haircuts. And as we were leaving the church, the padre pulled my father aside, and my sister was close enough to overhear that the pastor said pretty much these words: "Abel, when my male parishioners come to Mass, they usually wear a suit, or at least a dress shirt, a tie, dress pants, and dress shoes." My dad was a plasterer. He worked with these his whole life. We moved to Hanford because he wanted his kids to grow up in the country and to have horses, which we did. We learned how to ride at a very early age. My grandfather was an excellent horseman and won many roping contests at rodeos in Southern California. So we grew up in the country, and when we went to Mass, my dad would wear a nice Western shirt, usually his good blue Levi's, and his good cowboy boots. And my father nodded his head and thanked the padre for sharing that with him. And a couple weeks later, we get Mohawk haircuts. And my father says, as Mass is getting ready to start, he told me, "Alan, just wait. As Mass is starting, I want you to lead us and find us a seat in the front." Which was unusual because we usually sat in the back. I go, "Okay." As Mass was starting, he goes, "Okay, Alan, lead us and find us a spot in the front." He knew that the padre started Mass the same way every Sunday. The altar boys came out, padre came out behind them, and the first thing he did was bless Jesus on the cross with holy water. And after he blessed Jesus on the cross with holy water, he turned to greet his congregation. That Sunday when he turned to greet the congregation, walking down the center aisle was little Alan Salazar, 6 years old, with a Mohawk haircut, my brother Abel with a Mohawk, and in the back, Pop with a Mohawk, with a nice Western shirt, his good blue Levi's, and his good cowboy boots. My sister, who was the oldest, was a teenager at that time, said you could see smoke coming out of the padre's ears through the whole Mass. At the end of the Mass, my father made us wait until everyone had left. As everyone was, the last person was leaving, we got up to leave. My sister knew Pop was going to say something. Like I said, he was a Marine. And as he walked by the padre, my sister said the padre kind of looked the other way, hoping Abel Salazar would walk by him. But Abel Salazar walked up to him and put his hand out, so the padre had to shake his hand. Like I said, my dad worked with these all his life. My sister said you could see Pop putting the vice grip on him and pulled the padre in close to him. And he said to the padre, according to my sister, who I love dearly and believe without a shadow of doubt, because she leaned in, she knew Pop was going to say something. And he said, "Padre, when I come to Mass, I come to ask for his forgiveness and his guidance. But thank you for your words." That was a powerful thing to do or say when you're one of the few interracial couples, when you're one of the few brown people, native peoples in a small farming community. As we know, those of us that are old enough, in small towns, the pastors, the padres, they're leaders of the community. They're the pillars of the community. But my family was raised to be proud of our native heritage, to be willing to stand up and fight for what we believe. And the Fernandinho Tatavian people, the Ventureño Chumash people, are still here. We're still fighting to protect our land, and to have something to pass on to the next generation, and the next generation, and the next generation. I want to thank you all for listening. I probably went a little bit long, but I was going to go for another 30, 40 minutes. But I can feel presence going, Alan. So thank you very much. Thank you, Jeff.
As far as I'm concerned.